Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Alex Olgan, in for Mike Collins. It's that time again, the first of the year, when many of us make New Year's resolutions to eat better and exercise more. Fortunately, there's some good news for all of us in the new federal guidelines on physical activity. Even short bouts of movement can make a difference in our health. The guidelines come out every 10 years when a group of scientists, researchers, doctors, and officials get together to review the recent science and develop updated guidelines for physical activity. The newest recommendations were released in November, and the message is that any movement is good for you mentally and physically. For the first time, guidelines were added for preschool-aged kids, and the science shows that moderate amounts of movement can have immediate benefits on mood and physical health, as well as long-term benefits, like lowering the risk for certain cancers and chronic diseases. We spoke with a panel of experts about the new guidance in November, and we revisit that conversation this hour. Dr. Loretta DiPietro is an epidemiologist and professor in the Department of Exercise and Nutrition at the Milken Institute of Public Health at George Washington University. Hello, welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and she also served on the committee that came up with these guidelines, and she joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Also joining us is Dr. John Rady. He's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's an expert in neuropsychiatry and studies exercise's impact on the brain. He's the author of SPARK, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain, and he joins us via Skype from Boston. Hello, Dr. Rady.
Hello, glad to be with you.
Yes, thanks for joining us. And in the studio with us is nurse practitioner Chelsea Kane. She works at Atrium Health, and she focuses on health needs in the community. She does things like go to schools and do physicals, works in family clinics, and soon she'll work in these mobile clinics that go to different areas of Charlotte. She advocates for physical exercise as part of a treatment plan and highly values the need for adults to add this to their lifestyle. So thanks all so much for joining me. I was joking before we started the show and said, you know, I haven't done my physical exercise yet, but I will do that after the show today. So let's just first start with what's new in the guidelines. And I know, Dr. DiPietro, you were working on them, and it varies per population. But can we start with what's new for kids and how this is important, that it's the first time that there are guidelines for kids so young?
Well, that's the new part of it, that we now have guidelines for children that young, and we now recognize how important physical activity in an active lifestyle is across the entire age spectrum. I imagine the next set of guidelines will include toddlers.
Wow. You think in the next, I guess that would be 2028, they would include toddlers.
And possibly the uterine environment and what goes on in there and how it affects children, and not just their physical activity patterns, but their cardiometabolic risk patterns throughout their lives.
And can you just go over what the new guidelines are for the 3 to 5 year olds?
Well, basically, it's incorporate movement as much as possible throughout the day, and basically like 3 hours a day of moderate intensity activity accumulated throughout the day. Just keep these little kids in motion. Reduce sitting time, reduce screen time, but mostly just keep them active.
So are we to take that as that they're not necessarily being active enough and that's why they're being added to the guidelines? Or is it just the science has enough evidence so now it can be, you know, official?
It's now there's enough scientific evidence to make statements, to make public health statements such as that.
Okay. And moving up the age spectrum, if you're 6 to 17, the recommendation is 1 hour of moderate to physical activity daily. And with adults, it's 150 minutes a week. And with these 2 days of strength training, I know that there have been some moderate changes with the adult levels and recommendations. Can you go over those changes?
Well, we now have, we're pushing a range, 150 to 300 minutes per week of moderate intensity physical activity. Again, especially for older adults, with the addition of 2 hours a week of muscle strengthening activity. And so that's, you know, we're pushing that range, but we're also, we discuss limiting sedentary time throughout the day for the first time. We now recognize the value of replacing sedentary time with light intensity activity, so that we're basically accumulating more activity throughout a 24-hour period. And also, another new addition is we used to talk about accumulating bouts of activity in at least 10-minute segments. And we're not discussing that anymore. Just accumulate it. There seems to be evidence now that any bout duration is good as long as it accumulates to a recommended level throughout the day.
And, you know, a lot of this, of course, it's very important that it's studied and that there are scientific guidelines. But I think a lot of this is, for some people, somewhat intuitive. We know that we should be moving. But, you know, for all of you, I think, I know, Chelsea, you see patients. Dr. Rady, I think you in the past have seen patients. Do you see that they know this intuitively, or is delivering information about these guidelines like really, really new to them? I guess we'll start with you, Chelsea.
I would say it's mixed. I see some people who know deep down, I know I need to be more physically active. You know, you don't have to drill home just how much. They know that. And then there's others who are maybe a little knowledge deficient in that regard. So I see both.
And what about you, Dr. Rady?
Yeah, no, I think there are both types. But most people do know that they should be moving, especially today. I think it's sort of heralded loud and clear everywhere that people should be moving to keep their bodies and their brains functioning well. And I think what they need to see a lot of the times is just the incredible amount of evidence we have, not just for their physical well-being, but for their psychiatric and psychological and emotional and cognitive well-being. And when they begin to see that, that can make a huge difference in their attitude towards exercise or play or moving.
I'm wondering about these guidelines. I mean, are they published really for the average everyday American, or are they really published for healthcare professionals to be able to have science to and guidelines to relay this information to their patients?
Oh, I would say if all of the above. I mean, these are public health guidelines. And the recommendations, they are recommendations for prevention. And these are not just for healthcare providers. They're for the general population. They're for school settings, healthcare settings, workplace settings. These are for everyone to take and use.
And just to follow up on that, Dr. DiPietro, I know that this committee that you were on that was developing these guidelines had been working for something like 20 months to develop them, and you guys reviewed lots and lots of research. How did you decide what kind of research to review? Can you sort of talk about what it was like to be on the committee?
It was like a third full-time job. On the other hand, I got to work with my incredible colleagues. It was a lot of time. We had help from an outside firm that helped with the literature searches, and we first came up with questions that we wanted addressed in the guidelines, and these questions came from, you know, what's missing in the literature right now, what haven't we discussed in the 2008 guidelines, and you know, where, what will have the greatest public health impact. And so we started there, and we constructed our questions in the different subcommittees. We had an outside consulting firm that helped us do the literature searches. As you can imagine, the massive amount of literature that's out now, we decided to only synthesize data and findings from systematic reviews and meta-analyses. So that cut down the literature tremendously because we're not reviewing papers twice. And so basically that was the academic, the scholarship parts of it. We had people reviewing titles and abstracts, and then reviewing the full manuscripts to make sure that they met the guidelines and criteria for inclusion into the review, so there were lots of checks and balances. There were weekly phone calls for each committee and then the committee heads to address any issues that needed to come up. There was lots of peer review. So it was a very work-intensive yet very satisfying exercise for me.
That's great. And just for people who aren't aware of what meta-analyses and systematic reviews are, could you just sort of summarize what that means?
Sure, of course. A systematic review will be a very strict, standardized review of the literature on a given topic, and the basic findings will be synthesized into one big paper. Many of these systematic reviews also include what's called meta-analyses. It's a compilation of all the statistical data included in each of the randomized trial or cohort study or cross-sectional study. These meta-analyses will synthesize the data points and come up with a summary statistic to demonstrate the strength of the association across all these different studies between, say, physical activity and improved cognitive function.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk more about that in just a couple minutes with Dr. Rady, because I know one of the things that you study is exercise's effect on the brain. But just, Chelsea, for you, when you talk to patients about the need to get moving, do they ever ask about research? Do you ever point to the research, the findings?
Usually the patients don't point to the research. I will, in terms that they understand,
sure,
and that will resonate with them.
So what kind of, if I was a patient and I'd say, well, why do I need to do this? How do you sort of talk to them about the research and, you know, why it's good for them?
I'll use plain language, everyday language, and basically just talk to them about, say you're diabetic. One way I would explain how physical activity would improve their blood sugar control, I would say that exercise will help use up the extra sugar that's in their blood for energy.
In ways they can understand.
Exactly.
And people seem to get that.
Yes.
That makes sense. And do you look at, obviously you look at current research to be able to share that information with patients?
Yes. Like the time that's recommended per week,
mm-hmm,
you know, I will, you know, be very specific with those time frames and point to the research in that regard.
And how, one thing I've always wondered is, how do you, people tend to overestimate how much they exercise. How do you get realistic sense of whether or not they're reporting accurately?
Ask specific questions, what they're really doing.
And they tend to then, you get to get a real sense of whether or not they're meeting those,
yes,
numbers.
Yes. You know, how often are you exercising? What are you doing whenever you're there? How long are you actually doing it? You know, break it down a little more specific.
That's Chelsea Kane, nurse practitioner with Atrium Health. We're also talking with Dr. John Rady, clinical associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's an expert on the impact of exercise on the brain, something we'll talk about after we get back from the break. And Dr. Loretta DiPietro is with us. She's an epidemiologist and professor in the Department of Exercise and Nutrition Sciences at George Washington University. She's a member of the 2018 Physical Activity Guidelines Advisory Committee. We're talking about the federal guidelines released in November that recommend most of us get 25 minutes of movement a day. Only about 20% of Americans actually meet those guidelines. We'll talk more about why and ways you can increase your daily activity. To see the full guidelines and what's recommended by age group, go to WFAE.org/CharlotteTalks. We'll have more in a moment. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Alex Olgan, sitting in for Mike Collins. We're talking about exercise today and the federal guidelines that came out in November about how much exercise we need. only about a fifth of Americans meet the guidelines of 25 minutes of activity every day. We're talking with Dr. Loretta DiPietro, an epidemiologist and professor in the Department of Exercise and Nutrition Sciences at George Washington University. She was on the committee that helped develop the guidelines. We're also joined by Dr. John Rady, clinical associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and Chelsea Kane, a nurse practitioner with Atrium Health. We're going to talk now about the science behind why exercise is so important and its effect on the brain. Dr. Rady, I want to start with you. I know a lot of your research focuses on the brain-fitness connection. Let's start with some of the basics. How does exercise have a positive effect on the brain?
Yeah, there's so much that has been discovered, written about, unpacked, finding exactly what almost to the enzymes that are being changed with exercise in the brain. And it's been a very exciting time the past 20 years. But what we know is that most of our brain was constructed to help us be the best movers that we can be. That's how we were the evolutionary victors, that we could move better than any other species. And we grew a big brain to help us do that. And that big brain then we co-opted, we started to use it instead of just for moving, but for thinking and talking and interacting and relating, so that as our social environment grew, so did our brain and its usage. And so when we're moving, we're actually activating using the same nerve cells that we think with, that we feel with, that we control our emotions as well as take in new information and help us deal with the ever expanding world that we live in.
And I was watching one of your TED Talks and I noticed that you started the TED Talk by having everyone do squats. Why did you start that way?
To be specific, they were Hindu squats. So yes. You got the upper body as well as the lower body moving. And why do I do that? Because when you move your muscles, you move your brain. Your brain turns on. And an important area of the brain that I wanted to affect there was the attention system. Keeping your attention focused, being able to stay with it, not being distracted, turning on what's called the executive area of the brain, and just even, as you say, now it doesn't have to be even 10-minute segments. It could be 3 minutes of exercise or 2 minutes will change your brain dynamics, will change the chemistry as well as the electricity in your brain, and particularly pump up your ability to attend to what it is you're supposed to be attending to.
I noticed that at least one of the research projects that you did was with this school, and when you had in Charleston, South Carolina, actually, and when the school had kids do exercise in the morning, you found that discipline rates significantly dropped. Can you tell me a little bit more about that study and why you think maybe that happened?
Oh, yeah. No, and that's happened in every school that we've been involved with. And what this is a very underserved school with a very difficult population, and the kids were in grades 4 to 8 and came in every morning and were met by the one PE teacher they had, and she put them through a series of games every morning. 8 minutes on playing basketball, on double dutch jump rope, on playing Dance Dance Revolution, doing other interesting and novel activities, but got them moving for a good 24 minutes during a 30-minute period. And what did this show? In the first semester, compared to the semester before, there was an 84% drop in disciplinary referrals to the principal. So not only was the principal very, very happy, but the teachers were very happy because they no longer had to be just policemen in their classrooms. They could actually teach, and they had willing and attentive students to take in the information. So what happens is your brain gets turned on. The front part of the brain, the executive function area, gets turned on. Your attention gets better. You're able to block impulses naturally, not even thinking about it. You just put the brakes on sort of the impulses that come up from below because you're attending. And this leads to an improvement all around, an improvement in attention, improvement in the memory ability, improvement in motivation, and a boost in their mood. You get a lot of very specific benefits, but overall, you get better students.
Yeah, it sounds like sitting and studying isn't necessarily the only way to be a good student. You need to be active as well. I know, Chelsea, you do some physicals in schools. Do kids ever talk about the physical activity they get inside school?
Sometimes. I mean, I feel like they're always in school. They're constantly playing gym. You know, they're walking between classes, things like that. At least the schools I've been in, middle school and whatnot. But I think that there is room for improvement there in being intentional with their activity.
Mm-hmm. And how do you, I'm sure it's very different encouraging kids to move more than it is encouraging adults. So how do you, are there different tactics you take when you're talking to kids?
I will talk to them a lot about screen time and playing outside and moving around and encouraging them to be as healthy as they possibly can, especially whenever they get older.
Do you talk to them about maybe sports and things like that? Things
Absolutely.
That they would,
okay. I really encourage participation in sports and exploring their interests, what kind of makes them tick, what they're passionate about, and then encouraging that.
Okay. And Dr. DiPietro, I know that you actually don't have a sitting desk in your office. You have standing desks, right? And all your meetings are standing meetings. Is that right?
That's correct.
Do you feel, I mean, obviously you probably still have screen time given that you're working on a computer, but I've read that you said that meeting these guidelines would require some big cultural shift because we do have a lot of screen time just as a society. I have noticed just anecdotally that over the past 5-6 years that there is more of an emphasis on moving and walking. And are you noticing that? Is that cultural shift happening at all?
It's happening. It's happening slowly, but I really believe it's gaining momentum. And so that's why we're thrilled that the new guidelines address sedentary behavior. So, you know, working at a computer all day, many of us, that's the nature of our jobs, but you don't have to be sitting all day to do that. You can mix sitting with standing. You can take a break and walk around the building for 5 minutes, go climb a set of stairs. I think, you know, one of the most encouraging aspects of these new guidelines is that 10-minute criteria that, you know what, it's all good. It's physical activity of any duration. And, you know, if you can get a good, vigorous 2-minute bout in climbing the stairs, that's still better than the time you were spent sitting.
Yeah, and I know that a lot of the emphasis is on preventing or dealing with chronic disease like type 2 diabetes and heart disease and high blood pressure. And DiPietro, I think I read a study of yours where you talked about walking for shorter periods of time, even after you eat meals, was really effective at controlling glucose levels in your blood. Is there like an optimal time that we should be getting these minutes of exercise?
So that study pertain to older people who were at risk for type 2 diabetes, right? So you want to prevent them from crossing that boundary and going on medication. And so for people of that age, we demonstrated quite convincingly that if you wait a half an hour after you put down your fork, which means, you know, your food has been absorbed and it's about to circulate through the blood. If you just do a 15-minute walk, just the contraction of muscles will dispose of the glucose, you know, and store it into the cell. The thing is, you have to repeat that every day to get that benefit. Is it going to result in weight loss? For younger people, no, that's not a strong enough stimulus. But for a very specific outcome, we now have specific activities and the timing of such that make them most effective.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the new federal guidelines for physical activity and some benefits exercise has on the brain. Our guests are Dr. Loretta DiPietro, professor of exercise and nutrition sciences at George Washington University, Chelsea Kane, a nurse practitioner with Atrium Health, and Dr. John Rady, clinical associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Rady, I know you mentioned that when you exercise, you turn on your prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for learning, and that primes students to perform better in school. Are you finding that with adults at work as well?
Oh, yes. I mean, just as Dr. DiPietro had all the standing desks in or no chairs, Richard Branson has no chairs in his new building that he just built. And all of his meetings are walking meetings. So it's really hit the industry in a big way. I mean, the standing desk is now being advertised. There's a couple of them now. But that started about 20 years ago in the schools in Minnesota, where the teacher had everybody stand and found that the kids were much more focused. They took notes better. They didn't act up as much just by standing, because when you stand, you are using a lot of big muscles. And when you use those big muscles, it turns on your brain more. In fact, I'm standing now talking to you.
I'm standing as well talking to you.
Oh, you are.
And I'm doing squats.
That's great. Unfortunately, Chelsea and I are sitting. If we stand, we're too tall for the microphones. But we definitely take that to heart. So, Chelsea, do you tell people even small things like standing at work can make a difference?
Oh, yeah. I like to emphasize, not exercise. I like to use the word moving. That's what it really boils down to, is moving your body. I like what Dr. DiPietro said, you know, it's really cumulative of 24 hours. And I think that really resonates with patients, because it's not like, oh, I have to cut out an hour of my day that I really don't have. And it seems more doable.
Yeah, it seems like a more bite-sized chunk that they can accomplish.
Exactly.
And that was one of the things I was wondering, because with these guidelines, obviously the 25 minutes, that's the recommendation that's proven by science. But is it like the lowest common denominator, in the sense that that's a bite-sized chunk that everyone feels like they can do?
Well, if you ask many Americans, they feel that they cannot do the minimum requirement of 150 minutes a week. Don't forget, we now have evidence that you can be a weekend warrior and get it all in 2 days. I mean, that's not preferable, but it's still effective. But most people feel they can't accomplish that, when in fact they can. And many people think, oh, I can't go to the gym. And the evidence is now is you don't need to go to the gym. The body doesn't care if you're moving your muscles on a treadmill or raking and bagging your leaves or vacuuming or walking to work. It's movement, as Chelsea said. We need to accumulate movement throughout the day.
It's the message of just do anything. Doesn't have to be traditional exercise. Doesn't have to be on a treadmill, any of those things.
No, the body, I mean, we talked about Paleolithic, our hunter-gatherer ancestors, all right? The body doesn't know the difference between a treadmill and walking to work.
One thing I wondered, and this is a question for all of you, is if you guys think social, like doing social physical activities accounts for more adherence to doing it on a daily basis. Like if you have that accountability of your friends saying you weren't at walking group yesterday, that kind of thing.
Oh, there's
Absolutely.
No question about that. I mean, there's so much more benefit to doing exercise with another person, not just the accountability, but it really makes your brain work harder when you're with someone talking and just interacting, and harder in a good sense. And the harder your brain works, the more impact you're going to have on your brain. So the social group is important for the accountability, but it also what we call vitamin C or connection is so vital and important for your physical and mental health. So it's absolutely something that we recommend.
So working harder, Dr. Rady, because you're also talking and flexing those brain muscles as well as the physical muscles?
Yes. You're more of a challenge all the time. another person makes it harder but better for your brain. No, your brain loves to be challenged.
And Dr. DiPietro, did you want to add something? Did I hear you?
Oh, yeah. The guidelines, you know, in the chapter on brain health and also the chapter on older adults talks about the value of multitask exercise where, you know, it's you're walking, but you're also talking and interacting with the environment or walking and counting backward. So combining a cognitive, a social, and a physical task, it's, you know, it's a three-way challenge to the body. And if you can juggle, you know, while you're doing that, I mean, even better. Things like ballroom dancing, tai chi, they stress multiple systems.
And I have to imagine for those of us that covet our time and really value efficiency, that just feels like that would be the best circumstance because you can get all the benefits in one compact period of time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. And so, you know, adherence, I'm sure, is a major problem. It is a major problem, obviously, because we see that only about a fifth of Americans meet these guidelines. I'm sure that each doctor or nurse or advanced clinical practitioner sees that with their patients. Any sort of overall thoughts, Dr. DiPietro, about adherence? Anything that has really worked well that you found in the research?
Make it a behavior change, start slow, make it a habit, do what you love to do. Because if you love what you're doing, then you'll stay with it. And then as people see the benefits, that's its own reward. And adherence tends to increase after that. But many people start off, you know, thinking they have to do the entire weekly prescription all at once. So the recommendations are work up to 150 minutes per week and just get it any way you can.
And we'll continue talking about ways to meet those guidelines after a short break. We're talking with Dr. Loretta DiPietro, an epidemiologist and professor in the Department of Exercise and Nutrition Sciences at George Washington University, Dr. John Rady, clinical associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and Chelsea Kane, a nurse practitioner with Atrium Health. We're talking about the new federal guidelines for physical activity that most of us are failing to meet on a day-to-day basis. You can see the complete rundown of what's recommended for your age group on our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks. More in a moment. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. You're listening to Charlotte Talks. I'm Alex Olgan, in for Mike Collins. We're talking about exercising and meeting the new federal guidelines that came out in November. They recommend adults get 150 minutes of physical activity in any form a week. Before the break, we were talking about adherence, how we make sure people are actually getting this exercise. Dr. Rady, you wanted to bring up some studies about adherence.
Yeah, the University of Michigan has been looking at this for a good 15 years, of what makes people come back. And their recommendation, finally, is to look at the result of your exercise that day, how different you feel today after you've exercised. We so much want to look at, oh, weight loss or getting cut or some long-term finding that it's all for the good. However, to get most people coming back is to look at, oh, I feel so much better. I feel so much clearer. I feel so much lighter and more motivated after I exercise. You don't have to have the endorphin rush that people get when they're running marathons, but just moving makes you feel better, more alive, and actually turns your brain on quite a bit. So it's just to look at today because we are so much better served by noticing that and logging that into our brains and not thinking, oh, I want to lose 20 pounds or whatever it is. I mean, sure you do, but it's today that's important.
The manageable chunks, the achievable chunks. Do you find, Chelsea, that you try and talk to patients like that, breaking it down into small, achievable sections?
Yeah, I mean, I think my role as a nurse practitioner is to really look at what barriers they're facing. You know, if they're having trouble with adhering to it, they're obviously in that stage of change where they're trying to make it happen. And I think my role is get creative with them and how can I get this person, get their time back if that's the issue. You know, not too long ago, I can recall a working mom with two teenagers and her issue was lack of time, taking care of her family, busy, busy, busy. And I had to basically look at her situation and help her overcome. Okay, you've got two teenagers. You're busy on the weekends grocery shopping. Why don't we see? They can drive. Let's let them get the groceries. They're going to be going to college soon. They need to be doing that. And then that'll give you a free window of a couple hours. Go exercise. I think it's stuff like that that can help with adherence.
Help remove other barriers. Absolutely. And talk them through that.
Can't give them more time.
Right.
But I can. We can get creative.
So do you know, have you followed up with that patient? Has she been able to do it?
You know, that wasn't that long ago, so I haven't seen her yet. I hope so.
Yeah, I bet.
Or maybe these kids can grocery shop now.
Right, right. Helping out their mom is also a good thing.
Right.
So Dr. Reedy, I know that in Boston, you were noticing that when the marathon became popular, a lot of people were running it. But then when runners got injuries and they couldn't run the marathon, you saw them sort of noticing that they weren't feeling well, like they more signs of depression. Can you talk about that? You and your colleagues noticed those trends?
Yeah, no, that was a big finding. When people stopped running, they first got depressed, sometimes very, very deeply depressed. And then a number of them got an adult onset attention deficit disorder, which led me to one of my careers is following out attention deficit disorder. And because they were runners all their lives and all of a sudden they had to stop for a knee injury or an ankle injury. And this led to them having not being able to manage their attention like they always had done so before. But we have lots of evidence about exercise's effect on mood, on our anxiety and on stress. I mean, those are huge areas where exercise makes a big dent. And preventing depression from coming, preventing anxiety, and all of its incredibly positive effect on managing our stress.
Do you think there's any correlation between rising levels of depression among Americans and you know, people not living the sedentary lifestyle?
Oh, I think there's a lot of evidence to say that that's true. You know, where you have a very active populace, you have much less depression and anxiety and lower rates of suicide, et cetera. And I think our society has really become more sedentary, even though I think there are inroads. There are hopeful signs of us wanting to be more active, although a lot of the times it's wanting to and not doing it. So.
And how do we compare to other countries with these guidelines, Dr. DiPietro? Do other countries do similar kinds of things? And are there guidelines similar to what we publish in America?
The countries that do have guidelines are similar to ours. And in fact, the WHO has issued similar guidelines of 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity physical activity or 75 minutes per week of vigorous. So they're very similar across countries. Some countries might recommend, you know, a little bit more, which is why we have this range between 150 and 300 minutes a week, recognizing that some people may need more than that. So they are fairly similar, but keep in mind, many European communities are not as sedentary as we are in the United States, especially with regard to active commuting to work and to school.
Yeah, absolutely. And are there, I think I read in the guidelines, there was at least one study done about a prescription for exercise instead of a prescription for medicine in certain circumstances. Chelsea, do you ever find trying to do that with patients that maybe can get some of their health issues under control with exercise?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't actually put it on paper, but yes, I mean, there's a sort of a format to use, like the frequency, intensity, the type of exercise, and then the time that you want them to do it. For me, it's more of a conversation. And, you know, I find most of my patients are sedentary. So what I'm talking to them about is start out gradually, walking. Just start with walking. What do you like to do? Oh, I like to be with my kids. Oh, do you have a stroller? Yes, love to take my kids to the park. Okay, we'll kick it up to 30 minutes. Start out slow. Try to hit that 5 days a week or longer on the weekends if that's when your time is available. But that would be the form of prescription I would use. I haven't actually put it on a pad.
I understand. Well, I didn't know if there were certain chronic diseases, maybe like high blood pressure or high cholesterol, where you know someone could take some medicines, but maybe that could be also either mitigated or replaced with exercise, or is it not quite that stark?
I mean, initially, like, for example, type 2 diabetes, mm-hmm. you know, they're in that pre-diabetes, you know, where they can still turn the ship around. And we're putting it in terms that patients can really understand using that very plain language. No one likes to take pills. Oh, gosh, another medication. I don't want to do that. I mean, for the most part, that's how patients are. And I'll explain how exercise or movement will affect their blood sugar and give them that opportunity to do that instead, and then give them a sort of a time frame. Okay, 3 months, we're going to go back, we're going to measure, we're going to see where things are. And that generally works.
Oh, wow.
Not always.
No, I know, but it sounds like it's promising, even if it only works a couple times.
Yes, exactly.
And I hear you, Dr. DiPietro, wanting to add
making
to that.
Making noise.
No, go ahead, add to it. I'd be interested to hear, because I thought the way I understood the guidelines is that it's not just prevention, but once you even have these chronic diseases, any kind of movement can still help manage it.
Oh, yeah, the guidelines have several tables, especially in the chapter of pertaining to older adults. Basically, for prevention, it can mitigate most risk factors, such as hypertension or weight gain or high cholesterol. And in fact, you know, it's effective in treatment in many cases. So, I mean, I can't think of any risk factor or any disease that physical activity, you know, does not have a beneficial effect at any stage.
Mm-hmm.
And the guidelines talk about older adults with already established chronic conditions. Even they show improvements in physical function when they start a program.
And for listeners wondering exactly the details behind these guidelines, you can see all the guidelines and what's recommended for your specific age group at our website, wfae.org/CharlotteTalks. So one thing I've wondered, there's lots of employers have these fitness incentives, whether it's fitness trackers or discounts on insurance and things like that. Is there enough research, Dr. DiPietro, that you guys reviewed to suggest that was making any impact?
That topic wasn't part of the guidelines mission. The National Physical Activity Plan attempts to address that issue. You know, a lot of big companies are doing that. And, you know, they're incentivizing being active. And, you know, it's one thing to say you've joined a gym or you're doing this. It's quite another then to go at your yearly checkup and actually show improvements in biomarkers.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. We may be moving toward that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one thing I wonder is sometimes I've heard studies where healthcare workers aren't necessarily always following the recommendations that are laid out by them. And I'm wondering if you guys see in your academic circles or medical circles, are people meeting the guidelines, or do you see them getting exercise?
You could tell right away when you were all sitting around the table who is and who may not be. You know, it's a pretty self-selected bunch that work on the guidelines. But not everybody who's involved in physical activity and health meets the guidelines. They may try to. I mean, it's hard.
Yeah. What about you, Chelsea or Dr. Rady?
Yeah, I think that it depends. A lot of people now, a lot of my colleagues, for instance, know that exercise is so vital for the emotional and cognitive well-being, especially when we're thinking of preventing Alzheimer's disease and treating Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease with exercise, both of which can be very, very useful to slow the disease down or even reverse symptoms. And this has led a lot more people in middle age and onward to begin exercising again or continue or knock it up a notch.
And how about you, Chelsea? Do you find your colleagues are walking more? Like, I know sometimes we have walking meetings around our little pond outside.
You know, I think so. I think Atrium Health, we do a really good job of incentives to get people to reach that mark. For example, being at a healthy BMI, you'll automatically get $300 towards your HSA if you are between 19 and 25 of BMI. I mean, that money talks, and that gets people, you know, that gets results. But also, they'll do an incentive if you even try and show that you've made some progress towards your BMI. And I see that working. I mean, people really get fired up about that.
Yeah, that's great, especially competitive people.
Yeah.
Which I would include myself among them, although we don't have something that strict. So, Dr. DiPietro, I know that there are still things that are left to study. There was a whole part of the report that talked about research that you thought would be important ongoing. Any specific things that you wanted to bring up as hopefully something, research that will be done in the next 10 years that will inform the next guidelines?
Well, if I could determine the research agenda, number one would be the timing of exercise. You know, very similar to pharmacologic studies, it may make a difference when you perform the exercise with regard to your outcome of interest. So that's fairly unexplored. I mentioned before the uterine environment and how maternal physical activity affects, you know, the mother's postpartum, but also the child's trajectory of growth and health throughout their lifespan. And, you know, I think every committee recognized the need to study more diverse populations. We have to address health disparities in this country, and many of the people who volunteer to be in studies tend to be affluent, educated, and representing a small sector of the population. Therefore, we need to study more diverse populations.
And do any of the questions that you guys ask in the report, do you know, does that impact the way that the government funds ongoing research studies?
Wouldn't that be wonderful? I mean, we'd like to think that, you know, these findings would inform future studies. These studies tend to be much larger if you're in, you know, including multiple sectors of the population because you want to analyze your results accordingly. So I'm hoping, you know, that one outcome is informing funding.
And before we go, Thanksgiving is just around the corner. We're going to be eating a lot of turkey and pumpkin pie and unhealthy foods this week and doing a lot of sitting around. Any tips for average listeners to try and meet those goals during the holidays? Chelsea, I'll have you go first.
I'd say go for a walk with your family after you eat.
What about you, Dr. Rady?
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I think a walk outside, if it's possible, is a great way to finish off the meal.
And what about you, Dr. DiPietro?
Wait a half hour after your fork is down. And then I heartily agree. Outside in the sunshine, the rain, the whatever, go outside.
Dr. Loretta DiPietro is an epidemiologist at George Washington University. She was part of the committee that came up with these guidelines. Dr. John Rady is a psychiatrist with Harvard Medical School. He's the author of SPARK, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. And Chelsea Kane is a nurse practitioner with Atrium Health. Thank you all so much for the hour.
Thanks for having us.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.